Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Ruhrkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we're back with another episode in our series for this season. They didn't win for that. And we are modifying this theme once again to say they didn't get nominated, period. We are remembering Donald Sutherland today. With his recent passing, we will be talking a little bit about his career, what we love about his roles and his acting, and then we will be going into one of his standout performances in Ordinary People, talking a bit about that film, the Oscars of it all, and his importance to that film. So we'll be doing a lot, and I'm excited to chat about it.
Me too. I'm going to try not to cry. Donald Sutherland is one of my favorite actors ever. I've loved him for a really long time. Thank you to everyone who sent me messages the day that he passed away that you were thinking of me, because I think he really is, you know, one of the actors that I have gravitated towards over the years. And it's not just because of the films that he's been in, which I do happen to love quite a few of them. His roles are just so unique and his performances are really just, they're so different. He's a very physical actor, but he's also a very subtle performer. And those are things that I really appreciate about him. So I'm glad we have the opportunity, I think, to properly eulogize him. And his performance in Ordinary People and talking about his ridiculous, egregious Oscar snub, I think will be a great way to do that.
I think so too. And I know you really love this movie. I rewatched it for this pod. You've seen it way more than I have. And we'll get into the film and what I think about it. But starting with Donald, yes, he's a man of the 70s. He started his career in the 60s. He has so many different films like you're mentioning. We've talked about Clute on the pod. You and I saw JFK recently. I'm going to be mentioning that in a second, but he's done everything from Pride and Prejudice to The Hunger Games and Animal House. So he's done literally everything. What do you love about him so much, apart from being one of the quintessential 70s men of Hollywood?
Well, I think that when we think about quintessential men of the 70s or even just actors, typically we think of really conventionally handsome men. We think of Robert Redford. We think of Warren Beatty. Stretching further back, we think of Paul Newman. You think of these beautiful men who just look like what you think of when you think of a movie star. And Donald Sutherland is not that. I, of course, found him very attractive in all of his 70s movies. Love him. But when he was a child, he was called Dumbo because he had big ears. And he tells this story in the segment with Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes that when he was growing up, he asked his mom if he was unattractive. And she paused and...
Poor kid.
Or she said, like, you're interesting looking, right? Or something like that. I can't remember the exact quote, but... Yeah, it clearly stuck with him over the years, but he never really thought of himself as this handsome leading man type and didn't really think those sorts of roles were possible. But he got into plays, and then his career really, it started out with a moment of luck where he was just picked out of a crowd by the director Bob Aldrich for The Dirty Dozen when another actor didn't want to do the scene. So he just got picked and he stood out to producers at the time. And then, of course, he went on to have a really great career, like you were mentioning. And I think with the 70s, movies like MASH and Clute and Don't Look Now, he brings, I think, such a grounded presence to the roles. And he's not afraid really of anything. If you look across his career at the types of roles that he takes on, he does a lot of really strange, weird projects with the tour directors. He plays a lot of villains. And he also, in Ordinary People, what I love about him there that we'll talk about is that is one of the most sensitive, note-perfect performances I've ever seen by any actor. And you mentioning JFK too, right? It's like he comes on screen for 5 minutes and gives the best performance in the movie. So it's just little moments like that where I think he has the sensibility of a character actor and a leading man at the same time. That feels like something that's such a relic of the 70s in many ways, but also he worked really up until his death. He worked for over 60 years. So the fact that he wasn't nominated for an Oscar, it just feels like a silly footnote on this incredible career that he had. And I'm happy that he had an honorary, I'll say that. But he definitely deserved more, and we'll talk about those too. But yeah, one of the just the signature faces, voices, and presences really of Hollywood history to me.
Yeah. The fact that the biggest awards that he won were 2 Golden Globes and 1 Emmy, and one of those overlap is, I don't know, you can't really process that. And it's because of everything you said about his acting and his character. But in terms of the Oscars, it makes sense because he's so understated and his acting isn't showy. There's a fact, once we get to listener questions, about Robert Redford changing a scene to take out emotion, to focus on his cadence and his tone. And we'll see what we think about that when we get there. But I think that's why I like him in movies, is that he's not trying to be the star, quote unquote. He's woven into the fabric of the movie and he understands his place in the film. And I think that's really important. And it shows who he was as a person too. Kevin Jacobson had a question. What is your favorite of Sutherland's many great on-screen partnerships?
This is really hard because he has so many really good ones. I thought about being cheeky and saying Julie Christie and Don't Look Now, because the rumor about the famous sex scene caused Warren Beatty to throw a fit and try to convince Paramount not to release the movie. But I think if I really am thinking about who I love him with on screen, I was between two for this, but I'm going to go with Jane Fonda, because I feel like Donald Sutherland and Jane Fonda in Clute just have this magnetic chemistry and dynamic that brings out the best in both of them. I don't think that that performance is his best in his career, but I think there's a different quality to that movie because he is the actor in it alongside Jane Fonda. And they, of course, also dated in real life and were very good friends. And if you want to cry, read her tribute to him that she posted when he passed away. But they were also just, I feel like, a very cool couple and pair, because they were also so invested in everything with the anti-Vietnam tour that they did together. So I love that little detail as well. But yeah, I would say Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland for me. What about you?
I was going to say them too. And reading about them, Jane Fonda credits him for her having such an incredible performance and for all of the attention that she got. Clute is his name in the film, but she's the one with the Oscar at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that she still credits him. And without him, we could have gotten a completely different Fonda performance and film itself. And I think it's part of Sutherland's partially menacing nature, but in having to trust him, that makes the film so conflicting in a sense, and makes you want to go on this journey with them too. And why I love it for them too in it. My funny answer is JFK, because of what you said. He comes in this film, this unending monologue of conspiracy theories that the government is in on trying to kill JFK. And whether this is true or not, I mean, this is the entire film of 3 hours trying to figure this out, if it really happened. But in those few minutes that Sutherland is on the screen, you believe every word.
Yeah, I feel like, again, Donald Sutherland, my favorite part of that movie. I also was going to mention Elliot Gould, because they had really interesting parallel careers and feel like brothers, really, as actors. And I want to read one thing that Elliot Gould said about him that I thought was just really, really sweet. He said, "It's never easy losing the caliber of a human being, an actor like Donald Sutherland. But this one really profoundly hurts, because Donald was like my brother in a big part of my career." Because they started MASH together and they starred in Spies, which I also really want to watch. I need to find that from the library somehow. But just look up pictures of them at Cannes. It's great. It's like my exact type of man, just side by side, just like tall and big ears.
Yeah, there's a lot of his filmography I need to catch up on, from Six Degrees of Separation, which was an Oscar nominee, to Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I've only seen the original, and I know you've mentioned that one before. So there's just so much, and he has so many credits. So it's a fun marathon to have at some point this summer.
Yes, you definitely do need to watch Invasion of the Body Snatchers, because the iconic image of his face with his mouth wide open reacting, once you see what created that facial expression, highly recommend. Speaking of great movies, Ordinary People, let's get into this Best Picture winner and Donald Sutherland's performance here. Description of the film: the accidental death of the older son of an affluent family deeply strains the relationships among the bitter mother, the good-natured father, and the guilt-ridden younger son. This was directed by Robert Redford and stars Donald Sutherland, Mary Tyler Moore, Judd Hirsch, and Timothy Hutton. This won 4 Oscars: Best Picture, Director for Redford, Supporting Actor for Hutton, and Adapted Screenplay. It was nominated for 2 others: Best Actress for Mary Tyler Moore and Best Supporting Actor for Judd Hirsch. As you mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I have seen this movie many, many times. It is an all-time favorite of mine, but this was only your second time watching it. So what did you think of the movie as a whole before we get into Sutherland in particular?
The movie is beautiful. I think it's a movie for adults because there's so much to break down. The politics of the relationships and the emotions, and in just the subject matter, what Timothy Hutton's character, Conrad, has to go through. And I think that journey is really difficult, and it's a hard watch. I don't know how you've rewatched this so many times, because it is just bleak as hell. Yes, the performances are good, but there's also a point where you have to say, like, oh my God, how much trauma do you need to put on yourself to go through this experience again? To relive these performances. And I was feeling that by the end, but I think this rewatch was a little bit better because I was comprehending those relationships and internal struggles a bit more, and seeing the complexities of Donald Sutherland's performance as Calvin and him being the glue to this family, and in slowly trying to process what all of them are going through separately and bring them back together. And that's so hard to do. And I think a lot of people can relate to this just throughout the years. It feels very much like an 80s film, merging the 70s and 80s, but how families lived, and Beth needing to be this perfect, upstanding woman with no gossip on the town around her family and being very private. I think that for me was the hardest part to watch, because I could see it and understand it and also hate it at the same time. So I think there's a lot to love and converse about. I can understand why people maybe don't like this movie, but I totally understand why it won Best Picture too.
I mean, it's definitely, so about the rewatchability point, I find this movie very comforting. I can't really explain it, because it is bleak, but I think there is a catharsis that I feel by the end when you see Conrad and Calvin really just have each other in that moment. They've been through so much, and I find that very moving and powerful. And I think because, like, this film is so emotional and it is dark in what it's dealing with, but it never to me feels exploitative of the characters or of the actors. And that is really special. I think that it is one of those movies that is just very, very real. It's a movie that I think is universal yet entirely specific. You watch this family and you feel like the Jarretts are the only family who's experiencing this particular dynamic, because the characters feel so real and so lived in, and those performances are so perfect. But then at the same time, you think about how many families and people all over the world have to deal with the death of a child or a sibling, or feeling guilty for something that wasn't your fault, or, you know, I think this movie still is the best movie about mental health that exists. And it's over 40 years old now. I think what Redford did here with the direction, with the script, and with choosing these particular actors, I think he made something really magical. And I think I put this on my Sight and Sound list when we did our 200th episode. I was trying to think of when I've talked about this movie here before. But for me, it was funny because when I first watched this, I watched it in health class my freshman year of high school. We were doing a unit on mental health. My teacher showed it to the class and I didn't like it. I did not care for it. I remember really upsetting my dad because this is his favorite movie of all time. Like, number one favorite movie is Ordinary People. But it was because it was too real, I think. You know, I was Conrad's age when I watched it. I didn't really know, I think, how to process everything that I was seeing on screen. And I was also on the swim team. I have one sibling. I grew up in the Midwest in a suburb. Like, there was just too much there that I had to contend with. And that was really difficult, even though I hadn't experienced anything like what Conrad had experienced. But then I rewatched it. I decided to in college and it completely clicked in for me. And I immediately rewatched it twice within a week. I just was really fascinated by it and how real it felt and how different it felt and how I felt like every other movie that I'd seen that tried to talk about mental health either took it to the most extreme degree possible where it felt false, or they were just stealing from Ordinary People. This, I think, in so many ways feels like a blueprint for that type of movie, and I love it so, so much. And it'll be a while, I think, before I rewatch it. But this was the movie I watched the day that Donald Sutherland passed away because I knew I needed to watch one of his movies. And this one is the one for me. This is the one that I think of when I think of his incredible career. He's my all-time favorite movie dad. That's also when I've talked about it. Okay, I remember now also, and I think our first season, we did like a countdown of favorite movie dads around Father's Day. And I definitely had him on my list because I've always, always loved Calvin. I think he is the perfect, perfect movie dad. He has his issues at times, like in not speaking up to Beth, obviously, who is this ice mom. But I also want to ask you about this because you're also from the Midwest, and I think she's very real. And I know a lot of moms like Beth, but I think he just wants what's best for his family. He wants what's best for his son. He wants to, above all else, keep Conrad safe. And that's such an interesting thing to consider. And I think as I get older, I find myself being way more interested in what the parents are going through than what Conrad is going through, which is a recent shift for me. It was interesting to experience that on this watch.
I would say I agree with that too. You start to try to understand why the parents are doing what they're doing. And I think that's easiest to do in looking at Calvin because, like I said, he's trying to be the glue. Early on in the film, we have the French toast scene where Connie doesn't want to eat and Beth goes, "It's fine, but you can't say French toast." And she shoves it into the garbage disposal.
You can't say French toast. Brutal.
Like
those full pieces of French toast with the spatula, just like pushing it down into the garbage disposal. Ugh. Haunting.
And I think that's the first instance where you see in his eyes that he knows something is wrong, that he's trying to keep it together, and he's trying to understand Beth and Conrad. And from there, I would say that he's the most easygoing. He's trying to bring back reality to this family in a way that doesn't shock either of them. And I think another scene that I liked was at the party. He's sitting on the steps. He's having a drink or snack, whatever, with another woman who's at the party, a friend, and she asks about Conrad, and he's like, "Yeah, he's good. He's seeing this doctor." And Beth just across the room overhears him, and she goes, "Why are you talking about him? Why are you saying we have problems?" And then he's seeing a doctor, and you know, now it's going to get around, and people are going to be talking. And I think what he's doing is he, in putting this out there, what his family is going through, I think is trying to ease them back into the real world and to make it okay that things aren't okay, because obviously they aren't. Their son just died in this boat accident. And I think the way he handles that and the car ride home, especially with Beth, and in still trying to care for Conrad. He goes into his room. He's like, why are you still up? Making sure he's okay, that nothing is repeating from before. So I think the storytelling is really smart in that too. But the way we carry along with these characters, especially Calvin, is really important, especially in the first part of the film. So I do like our introductions to them.
Yeah. And I feel like it builds on the details so well. Like you talking about that party scene. Also, Donald Sutherland, great drunk actor. Underrated skill for actors, but he's very good at it. Just a little tipsy, not too drunk. Perfect on the stairs. And Beth, in that moment, plays nice. She doesn't scold him because she would never do that, right, in front of
in
a
public,
person at a party.
Yeah.
But she waits till they get into the car. And even before, in a scene before that, when they're talking about when Calvin is asking Conrad about how his visit to Dr. Berger was, you hear Beth ask where the office is. And you know it's not to ask, you know, like, how are you getting there? Or is it far away? But when he says Highland Park, she does this little twitch. And you know that it's because she doesn't want anyone to see him there. Like, it's too close to where her friends might live or someone might see him. And it is just so dark, because I think that the parts of the movie that do feel somewhat 80s are the responses to mental health and specifically seeking help and going to therapy. But there are still people today who view therapy similarly, who view it as taboo, or who don't think that you should talk about those kinds of things. And the movie is very progressive, I think, in how it talks about therapy and mental health. And it addresses those ideas really head on by having this couple have completely different opinions about therapy. We'll talk about the scene when Calvin goes to visit Dr. Berger. And he even recommends that they all go together. And that is just blasphemy to Beth. She would never do that. And I love how Mary Tyler Moore, perfect in this movie. But I love in that moment, too, how she basically frames it as, I can't have any more change in my life. I'm not changing anything else. Like, this is the way that it is. And I think it's easy to view her as a villain in the movie. And she's, I mean, absolutely horrible. Like, she in some scenes is like, fade on away, mommy dearest. But when she, there are certain ways that she frames things and you're like, okay, I kind of understand you. Not that I would act like that, but it's the way that she was raised and these signals that she gets from the society that she lives in her perfect suburbia, that she can't handle anything else. She can't handle any more adjustments to the cookie cutter life that she wants.
Which is all the more reason why she needs therapy. I think both of them are going through things, and that hits on something else that Calvin says when he's talking to the therapist, and he's like, you know, I think they're more alike each other than they think they are. And that's when you really start to see them as similar characters, and that's why they're butting heads, I think, is because they're going through similar things and are a little selfish and are a little guilty. And that's near the end of the film, but in the beginning, yeah, you just see Beth kind of grinding against everything, and nothing is okay to her. That moment you mentioned when she asks about where the office is, I love the framing in this, because she's standing in the kitchen in the background and Calvin and Connie are in the foreground. So she's always distant. She's disconnected from them, not only in the script, whether she's on a phone call and she's laughing at the phone and totally ignoring Conrad. Like, that scene just floors me too. It's like she wants to get him out of his head so that she can feel this relief, and that what Conrad is going through is taking a toll on her too, but she doesn't know how to process that fully. So again, it's Calvin cluing us into what the other characters are feeling and maybe how we can reconcile that.
I think so too. And before we talk more about Calvin, I do want to talk about one more Beth scene that I think is just, I mean, there are so many horrible ones, but this one just always makes my skin crawl. And it's when Conrad comes home and he doesn't know that she's already there, but she's sitting in Buck's room and he scares her. And it's almost just like he caught her in this private moment. Like, she didn't want him to see her in that room or thinking about Buck or thinking back to that. And they have this horribly awkward conversation about trig, where he tells her what he got in a trig quiz. And he's like, oh, did you take trig? And she's like, you know, did I take trig? It's so strange. It's like these people don't even know each other. But the best part, I think, of her acting in that moment is that she is clinging to the wall. Like, he cannot touch her. He cannot be in her orbit at all, or she will burst into flames. It's horrible to watch. And I don't know, there's also just something so real about it. You just want to yell at her, like, give your son a hug. Let him touch you. But yeah, it's, I don't know. That scene in particular, I think, is really great. But I think just getting into Calvin, one of my favorite things really about the introduction to that character too is that when our first introduction to him is that he's asleep at this play. So at first, we don't really think anything is wrong, right? Like, they're kind of living this normal life. But Sutherland is the one who clues us in to the worry and fear about Conrad and his safety, because when they get home from the play, he's the one who notices that Conrad's light is still on. And in such a brilliant little subtle moment, you see this fear and sadness come over his face. Like, I need to check on him. Beth goes straight to bed. She's like, I'm over it. Night's over. Going to bed. And he's the one who stops in. He checks. He asks about the doctor. He brings up the Michigan State tickets. He's trying to bring back some normalcy to their lives. And he's the one who shows that he still cares about his son. And like you said, he's trying to kind of be this glue that's keeping this family together.
Yeah, in that moment, he's not pushing Connie to go see the doctor. He's like, oh, have you thought about it? How do you feel about it? Probably internally, he's like, you should go. But he's not pressuring him. And in the end, I think it's interesting how Connie reacts to him putting his foot down and that maybe he needed that sooner, but he's not being a pushover. He's trying to figure out Conrad and how he's processing things and to go along with that. And that is really like this tightrope of acting and trying to get the right balance of that, which he does really well. Do you have any other favorite scenes with Calvin or moments, quotes from the film?
Oh, I have so many, but I'll try to keep it relatively brief because I know we have some listener questions that we'll get into these. But I actually really love what you talked about with he's not pushing him, right, to go to the therapist, but he's the one who's so enthusiastic when Conrad finally says that he goes to the doctor. His face lights up when he says, how did it go? Like, he just wants to encourage him. And it's just such a good juxtaposition between this character and Beth. But I like when we have the moment, actually, that's really just about Calvin, when he is talking to one of his coworkers who has known him for 20 years. They're in downtown Chicago. And the conversation starts off with Calvin talking about how he isn't able to fire anyone. He says, I can never seem to tell anybody they're not making it. And it's this perfect little clue also into his relationships with his family. He's a very non-confrontational person. He's a peacekeeper. I think he likes to keep things copacetic. He doesn't want to fight. And I think we first see that really there, right? That's extending to his professional life. But also, losing Buck in this accident has crept into his professional life as well. I mean, how could it not? But his coworker says, where are you? Like, he's been really distracted. And in the scene, what always sticks out to me is actually this look that falls across Sutherland's face that it's one of those, again, like blink and you miss it subtleties of his performance. But when his coworker, his friend says, you know, he'll be gone in a year anyway, as in Conrad's going to go away to college, everything's going to be fine, he's going to have his own life, just like my daughter, she has her own friends, she has her own life now. But for Calvin, and the look that falls over Donald Sutherland's face in this moment is,
what you just said has a completely different meaning to me. Because my son might actually be gone tomorrow, gone in a different way, not as in going to college, but gone, period. Because my other son is. Like, he left, and that's something you don't get over as a parent. So, and it's in that scene that then leads to him daydreaming on the train. And it's just this, like, really beautiful, sad moment of him thinking back on this moment of not the accident, like what Conrad is remembering, but it's this moment of Buck and Conrad as kids. They're much younger and they're sort of like roughhousing and joking around, and he's in between them. That's what he remembers and that's what he misses. He doesn't remember this like dark moment of Conrad's suicide attempt or of Buck's death like Conrad does. He's remembering something that is really positive, but something that can no longer be. And you feel all of that just from Sutherland's face, like a wordless performance, which I think is just perfect acting.
Yeah, it's marvelous. And the other side to that is, you know, Beth is really heartbroken by losing Buck, and Calvin must be too. But I think when we see him, that's not what we think he's thinking, is that he's in the present and Beth is in the past. And all of those scenes where we start to see him distracted more and more, I think it's from dealing with everything with his family and in wanting Conrad to be better. And so in the end, he's like, I need to go see Dr. Berger too. And he does. And that's really what you would hope from somebody, is that if they need help, they'll go get it. And I think that subtle difference in their characters is really just shown by how he holds himself up. And then once he sees the doctor, there's this really great scene where he comes home and he's starting to doubt things. And it's not because Dr. Berger influenced him or told him to think a certain way. It's just he's home and Beth greets him and he's like, well, can we talk about the funeral? And she's like, no, why would we do that now? Why would you ruin a perfectly good night? And the way he kind of continues to pressure her and ask, like, why did you want me to change my clothes? What does it matter that I had a different color shirt on? And the fact that she just acts appalled and diverts and never answers him is really the answer to the film and where he is right now. Because then by the end, he's thinking more and more about this. But I think that confrontation, who his character hasn't been up to this point, tells us so much about his new sense of character and maybe where his future is heading.
Yeah, right. Like he's the character who grows in the movie. Beth does not. Right. Like we said, she doesn't want to change. She doesn't want anything to change because change is uncomfortable. Yeah, I love that scene in the garage. I think it's one of his best moments in the movie for sure. I'm just curious. What do you think is the worst thing that Beth does? Because I have a very clear answer to this and I'm curious what you think. My jaw drops every time, no matter how many times I've seen it. It makes me so angry and so sad.
I think the one thing is when she does have that awkward interaction with Conrad and she just goes into her room and closes the door on him as if he's like walking away, which he isn't. Like that conversation has not ended. And she's like just slinking into her room, embarrassed. Oh, that's so uncomfortable to watch. There's another moment, it's not as dramatic, but it's with her mom and they're taking the picture and they can't get the right picture.
The picture.
It's so uncomfortable and I'm like totally on Conrad's side in that scene.
Give her the goddamn camera. That's my favorite. He said we were all thinking, it's like, please just end this now.
And like the way she acts in that, it's like, why are you being so defensive? Just take a picture with your son that is alive and standing right next to you. It's it's infuriating. But she goes in the kitchen, she's talking with her mom, and they make some anti-Semitic remark about Dr. Berger. And then this whole thing with the plate and like the metaphor, she's like, I think it can be saved when it's broken in half. It's like, oh my God.
And she's like, it's a nice clean break.
If only she could use that in real life. But yeah, it's all of it. All of the Beth interactions are just have me on the edge of my seat and not in a good way. Like, just ready to fight.
Yeah. So mine is the scene with the Christmas tree when Conrad and Beth are yelling at each other. Everything escalates and he brings up that she didn't visit him in the hospital. And he says, you would have gone to visit Buck if he were in the hospital. And she says, Buck would have never been in the hospital.
Yeah.
It makes me so, like, I have chills thinking about it because it's something that it reminds me a lot of Toni Collette at the dinner table in Hereditary, where everything is just like word vomit coming out because she's so angry and grieving and doesn't know how to deal with it. And there's just no remorse for it. Like, she doesn't apologize. She doesn't even look like she said something that she shouldn't have. But it is the first time when Calvin goes after her and is like, okay, this is enough. You need to stop.
Yeah.
And I think that's when it kind of starts to shift for him a little bit. Because he defends her at first. It's like, oh, she had the flu. She couldn't come visit you. It's like, that is such a stupid excuse. You need to open your eyes and realize who your wife is and what she can and can't deal with.
Yeah.
She can't really deal with anything. That's the thing.
Yeah, and I think there are moments with her where you're like, is she just not coping? Or did she really love Buck more? And I think this was the moment that it's like, she loved him more. It's not a question anymore. And it's harder to be around her character if she's not going to change. Yeah, that's so heartbreaking.
Doesn't Buck kind of look like Robert Redford in the flashback? I thought they looked kind of similar. I was like, what's going on here?
It definitely wasn't what I was expecting Buck to look like.
But he's that like perfect blonde jock type. It's like, of course, like she would be more obsessed with her perfect older son than her more like bookish, quiet, emotional son. But like Calvin says, she and Conrad were the only two who didn't cry at the funeral. And you do start to see those similarities, I think, throughout.
Also with the flashback and how she is just enamored by Buck and his jokes and his storytelling, and Conrad's on the side, but she's just beaming over him. And yeah, either envisioning like a bright future for him, just seeing his potential, it's also hard to watch. Yeah.
I think let's get into some listener questions. And through these, we can also talk a little bit about Timothy Hutton in the movie too, who is also perfect in that role, which is a very tricky one. But we got a question from The Futurist. Do you each have one, all caps, one? So we need to just pick one. This does feel a little targeted to me because I probably have like five or six. But do you each have one favorite Sutherland moment from the movie? Plus, would either of you wear the sweater he has on in the final scene?
The collared sweaters just aren't for me. It's almost like a shawl or a cardigan too. Like, those just don't work for me. I don't know. I don't know if I see you in that either. How do you feel about that?
I had a sweater like that at one point, but it was back when I worked at J. Crew, and I had, I would say, a bit preppier of a look than I do now. I mean, don't worry. It's still there. All my button downs. But I do like a good, thick, wintry sweater. But that style, I probably wouldn't wear so much anymore.
Yeah.
I like the color, though. The color is nice.
The cream.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the Chicago, Midwestern, heavy clothing, the sweaters, the coats, it's all very 80s, but you feel the cold too, though.
This movie is so Midwestern.
Yeah. I think for my scene, I'm going with the dinner table scene at the very end when Beth wakes up, Calvin isn't in bed, and he's crying at the dinner table, which not only brings us back to where the movie started, all of the family drama started in the kitchen with the French toast, but it's this final confrontation between Beth and Calvin. But he says, you are beautiful and you are unpredictable, but you're so cautious. You're determined, Beth, but you know something? You're not strong. And I think when he says you're not strong, it just clicks. Everything makes sense. That's the point where he has to realize, do I want to be this way the rest of my life? Yes, I love this person I've been with for 20, 25 years, but is this the best for me? And my son, that is again alive, that she's not caring for in the way that he needs it. And something else he says, we would have been all right if there hadn't been any mess. And the fact that he says mess is just like, oh my God. This whole scene, this entire monologue and scene is perfect. It's longer than that. But again, it's understated and it's all in his cadence. And I think you need multiple times through it to really understand what he's feeling and getting across to Beth, who's just standing in the doorway. You know, she's not moving. She's like, yes, I've always loved you the same.
No, she doesn't even say she loves him. That's the thing. I've felt the same way about you. Like, she can't even say in this moment that she loves him.
There you go. Yeah. What's your scene?
So you also, in that one, you did mention my favorite Donald Sutherland line reading, which is the delivery of mess at the end of that. It is perfect the way he emphasizes it, because it's so true. If there hadn't been any mess, they probably would have been fine. And he brings that point home, I think, with that line. My scene is actually when he goes to visit Dr. Berger. I think that this is, in addition to that dining room scene, it might be my favorite bit of acting of his across his filmography. Like, it's probably these two scenes, honestly. But what really stuck out this time for me when I was watching it was what he's doing with his hands when he's in the chair. So normally he's a very like loose person if you look at his body language. But when he's sitting in that chair, first his fists are clenched. Like, he's making fists as he's talking to Dr. Berger. And then he starts fidgeting. He's picking at the upholstery on the chair. And it's just those little physical moments that make you realize that this person is so uncomfortable and is just in so much pain that he doesn't really know how to express. And you have to watch what his body is doing at the same time as hearing what he's saying, because he's trying to still be this affable, easygoing person when he's there. He keeps saying, you know, things like, oh, you can't tell me this, or I imagine there's privacy, right? He's trying to get Dr. Berger to warm up to him, right? Like, he is always this friendly, calming presence. But his body is communicating everything that's left out of those words. And I think that that's what's so striking about the scene, is that you feel like this character, he needs so much therapy. He needs to be there. He has to talk about himself. And he has that realization when he's there. And I think that's such a great moment for that character. And I do find myself always tearing up during that scene, because you feel like he's had such a breakthrough and he's turned a corner a bit, and he's going to grow and he's going to get better after all of this, after all the grief and after all the suffering that he's been through that he hasn't dealt with, similarly to how Beth hasn't dealt with it. She's ignored it by being cold and putting a wall up and pretending nothing happened at all. And he is rushing back into normalcy in a different way. So I think that the therapy scene, I'm so glad that it's in the movie, because I think it's so crucial to understanding both the Berger character and Calvin.
Yeah, and also while he's trying to figure out some of what Conrad has been saying to him, he's also trying to say the right things. Mm-hmm. And when he doesn't, he kind of tries to backtrack. That nervous energy, you feel it until they have that breakthrough, like you said. And I think that's why we get that confrontation in the garage after he gets home, is because he's been able to get rid of that awkwardness that his mind has been having. And like, how do I think about this in the right way? It's just, do it. You're not wrong. There's no wrong way to do this. And yeah, I think that's the magic of seeing Judd Hirsch and Donald Sutherland in that scene together. Yeah. I think going back to my dinner table scene really quickly, we had another listener question about this. So Jonathan Edwards said, Sutherland reshot his final scene with Mary Tyler Moore, but with Redford reading her lines because Donald felt he cried too much during the initial filming. If the film kept the original takes of Sutherland in tears, would that have gotten him the Oscar nom, since the Academy loves a good cry?
I love this question. It's very creative. Yeah.
Because as I was watching the movie, I think I would have liked to see him totally break down. And that's not really the character, but as Beth walks into the scene, you hear him crying. So you know it's happening, and I think the emotion is there through this monologue that he has. And I think if we saw him break down, I think the Oscar could have happened, because that's an Oscar scene. And there's no showy scene otherwise, apart from when he raises his voice for maybe 5 seconds, or at the very end, when he does that with Conrad. And Conrad's like, yeah, more of this. But yeah, I love this question because I think it maybe has some truth to it.
Yeah, this is a more convincing argument to me than any of the category confusion or category fraud questions that we're going to talk through, because it's actually getting into what the Academy really goes for, and that is over-the-top, loud performances, big, showy, transformative scenes. And I do think if he broke down a little bit more, because we do see him cry in the movie a few times, we see him with tears in his eyes, but if he had a big, good sob session, I think it might have happened. Mm-hmm. But I think the movie's perfect as it is. I think his instincts for the character were right, and I think he played it perfectly. But I do wonder if that's what it would have taken for the Academy. I think it might have.
And just thinking of Redford reading Moore's lines is just also funny. You know, like, he had to take over to get a different kind of reaction that he was looking for, which makes you think of Redford's direction too. But I mean, the fact that him and Mary Tyler Moore had that acting relationship throughout this shoot, I think speaks a lot as well.
And then our next question comes from Andrew Carden. Had Sutherland been nominated, what would you have chosen as his Oscar clip?
I think it's easy to say one of the final ones, either at the dinner table or when he's with Conrad at the very end and maybe leading up to them saying, I love you, to each other. But maybe it is something lighter towards the beginning, once Conrad goes to therapy and he's encouraging him. I wouldn't mind seeing that either, of him smiling and being into it, because he doesn't get really happy a lot in this movie either. So I think that's another range of emotions that could still play really well in an Oscar clip.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we got to cover this like on Contenders and we got to pick Oscar scenes for all of them, I do know exactly which scene I would pick for all four of them. I think they have a lot of options, but I feel like for Donald Sutherland, I would have gone with the one scene that you mentioned, the dinner table scene. I feel like it is a perfect classic Oscar clip of a character, because we do get to see, even though it's not over the top, we do get to see emotion from him. It's this big, I think, revelatory moment for the character, and it has some of the best writing for the character in the movie, and he really makes the most of it, like we talked about with those lines that you read. So I feel like that would be the one that I would pick.
Next question comes from Rob Montoya. Was it category confusion that caused Sutherland to miss out on a nomination?
I think category confusion could be part of it. I think that you could make the argument that he could be lead or supporting, and we'll talk about that in another question, but he is top billing. He's the first name that comes up in the credits. He's the dad. So I understand, right, thinking of him as a lead, but at the same time, he has significantly less screen time than Timothy Hutton, who wins supporting. Also, his performance is not as big of a transformation as someone like Mary Tyler Moore, who was known as America's sweetheart. So it was a huge deal that she was playing this ice queen of the Midwest when she was the happy queen of the Midwest in the Mary Tyler Moore show. But I think category confusion is part of it. But I also want to read a quote that I came across in every Oscar fan's favorite book, Inside Oscar, where after the nominations were announced, he was on the Today Show the next day and he said, "I'm not surprised. I know that community and I didn't expect a nomination."
Oh my God. So he knew all along what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we might all be surprised, but he was not surprised. He said, "I know them. They're not going to vote for me."
Wow. I would agree with your answer because as I was watching the movie, I was trying to place them in supporting her lead, and it's just really difficult, I think, in how the screenplay works. If we're looking at their screen time, Donald Sutherland has a few extra minutes in the film compared to Mary Tyler Moore, and she's in lead.
Yeah.
And the fact that both Timothy Hutton and Judd Hirsch are in supporting Timothy Hutton with over an hour of screen time is kind of absurd. That's another question we have, is from Gregory O'Neill. What if the studio ran Hutton in lead and he got nominated? Would Sutherland have gotten in for supporting? And I think my hot take here is, we haven't really talked about this, I don't know if this is bad or not, but I would have taken out Judd Hirsch and at least put in Donald Sutherland, but I could have not had Hirsch in.
Oh, I like him in this.
I like him. He's not bad.
I think he's perfect.
He's just...
I mean, he's clearly in fourth.
Not,
like, if you're...
Yeah.
It's an all-star team, and he is the slowest member of the relay.
It's just, if we're talking about loud, showy, flashy, Oscar-nominated roles, this is not that. He's perfectly fine. He's a great therapist, psychologist, but if you're potentially trying to nominate all four actors from a film, there's usually a really good reason for that. And I think it goes beyond having three actors in supporting actor and having to choose between them. But my choice would have been, yes, put Hutton in lead where he should have been. He probably wouldn't have won, or it would have been a stronger race between him and De Niro, who won for Raging Bull, and then put in Sutherland in supporting.
So I'll respond to this question, then I do have another question for you based on that, because I do love Judd Hirsch in this movie. I think he is deserving of the nomination. I don't like him as much as Sutherland, of course. But yeah, I'm so pessimistic when it comes to Sutherland and his just complete bad luck with the Academy that I'm tempted to say he still wouldn't have gotten in to supporting.
Yeah.
But I do think he probably would have. The question I have for you. So originally, Robert Redford wanted Donald Sutherland to play the therapist. He wanted him to play Dr. Berger, and Sutherland didn't want to play him. He said, "What if I play the dad instead?" So it worked out that way. Gene Hackman, originally also considered for Calvin, love him. Don't think it works in the same way as Sutherland. But if Donald Sutherland played Dr. Berger, would he have gotten in?
I would say no.
See, he just has such bad luck because he's so subtle.
Which is why I was asking myself, like, how did Judd Hirsch get in?
I mean, how did he get in for The Fabelmans?
Well, that's more acting there. I think that's a little different.
I think they just like him a bit.
Right.
But, yeah.
The other side to that is I don't think Mary Tyler Moore should have been in lead. And maybe that's something with just how categories were treated in the 70s and 80s, but I don't know about that placement either.
Well, one of the things that haunts me always, because Mary Tyler Moore losing for Ordinary People is one of my great all-time Oscar sadnesses. I think she should have won Best Actress, even though Sissy Spacek is great in Coal Miner's Daughter. The thing that haunts me is if Mary Tyler Moore ran in supporting, I think she would have beaten Mary Steenburgen, and I think she'd have an Oscar for the movie.
Well, that would have been my other question for you. I have not seen many of these movies. The Great Santini, Melvin and Howard, that's what Mary Steenburgen won for. Lots of catching up to do.
I was going to ask you when you said you'd take Judd Hirsch out. I was like, have you seen The Great Santini or Melvin and Howard? Because I do think your answer might change. I think it's just like the acting in Ordinary People is like one of the big standouts. So that's where you're seeing a lot of the Oscar representation. It's just shocking to me that Sutherland isn't included.
Right. And that thought led me to think, you know, this movie that won Best Picture and Director and had all of its other nominations in acting, and it won screenplay too, no technical nominations at all. And I think that would be a rare case today to have something like that happen and actually win Best Picture. I'm surprised it didn't have maybe cinematography or editing or something like that, because again, the blocking, which maybe they attributed to the direction, is really strong. And I don't think it's just an above the line film.
Our next question comes from Brian Rowe. If Sutherland had been rightfully nominated for Best Actor, which person who actually got in do you think would have been omitted? So our nominees here, Robert De Niro won for Raging Bull. We also had Robert Duvall for The Great Santini, John Hurt for The Elephant Man, Jack Lemmon for Tribute, and Peter O'Toole for The Stuntman. And then in supporting, if you think he belongs there, we had Timothy Hutton, who won for Ordinary People, obviously. We had Judd Hirsch, Michael O'Keefe for The Great Santini, Joe Pesci for Raging Bull, and Jason Robards for Melvin and Howard.
I think my thing is I wouldn't put him in lead. And if he actually did get nominated, I would have been shocked. But I would probably say Jack Lemmon for Tribute, because that was the film's only nomination that year. With the other films, you see them in other categories, either acting or otherwise. So they're definitely stronger. But again, in supporting, it's hard. You have three actors from one movie in supporting, which is very rare, or you switch them out.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that Jack Lemmon for Tribute, he would have been first up to go. Also, the only movie of these that I haven't seen.
So our next question comes from Chauncey Talese. Do you consider Hutton in supporting category fraud?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite Oscar wins. I love this performance. I think it is pretty flawless. I've said before that Timothy Hutton invented Timothy Chalamet, and a variety of other emotional, sad boy performances. They don't exist without Hutton here. I love the win, but it's in the wrong category. Completely the wrong category. As much as I said that I focus on the parents now when I watch the movie, I think about them and their struggles. He owns this movie for a good amount of it. Like, it is his story. He is the one who's learning about himself, and he's recovering, and he's grieving, and he's growing as a person too, and discovering what all of this meant for him. And it's really, really painful. And I feel that even his louder moments where he's screaming and yelling and acting out with Dr. Berger the accident, it all still feels real. And I think that's a huge task, especially for a young actor like Hutton. He was 20 when he won. So again, love the win. Completely the wrong category. He should be in lead.
Do you think he would have won in lead?
I would have voted for him, actually, over De Niro. I think that's one of De Niro's signature performances, but I still would have voted for Hutton. I think De Niro still wins because he has more industry stature. He really transformed. I mean, you have the weight gain, and it's his movie, really, and Hutton is such a newcomer that I don't think he would have been able to take him down, but I would have voted for Hutton.
He had been nominated before, too. I mean, he had won as well, but I think, yeah, it's too strong. The other thing is, this is Hutton's feature film debut at 20, which he still holds the record for being the youngest supporting actor winner. Lots of things happening there, which I think would have just been hard in lead actor anyway, which is maybe why they did what they did. And that's why he won. But I do really like his performance. Nothing's too over the top. We don't have the scene of like him in the bathtub and like just trauma viewing.
Right. This isn't Lars von Trier's Ordinary People, thankfully. Like, it's Robert Redford's Ordinary People.
Which I very much appreciated that. And that gives Hutton more to do. And that's, I think, why I like the performance more in the end. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is, I think, such a product of the Academy, even still today, but especially historically, they see young boys as supporting. this isn't a child performance technically, but it's almost like they're viewing it as that. So it's like, okay, he's young. That means he's supporting, which is just not how any of this should work at all. So we have another question from Chauncey Talese. Would the movie's legacy be better if Scorsese won director and ordinary people still won picture? So we can talk a little bit about the legacy. I think this movie, because it won picture and best director, it has been maligned historically. I think people just see it as the movie that unfairly won against Raging Bull.
I think for me, and again, like I've only seen this movie twice in a few years, I've never thought of Ordinary People as having a bad reputation for winning Best Picture, but maybe that's also because I don't think of Raging Bull as Marty's like big win that he should have won for. I think there are other movies that he's been nominated for that should have. I think Raging Bull is Robert De Niro's picture and he won for that. And I think that's fine. I don't think a split would have eased the general public about how they feel about Ordinary People. I think it's actually a smarter commentary on it having won and the fact that people will watch it more and understand mental illness and this family drama that I think is really telling.
I think it would have improved it a little bit just because I think that people would have been more appreciative. I guess the Raging Bull fans who think, you know, like, oh, a movie should be technically perfect and this black and white dazzling thing that should win picture and director and every award possible. I feel like Scorsese fans can be very bullish about his movies, especially in the Oscar race. Raging Bull is just, and I love Martin Scorsese, but Raging Bull, not one of my favorites of his. I wouldn't have been mad if Scorsese won director. I think it would have been a very deserving win. Mm-hmm. But I would have voted for Ordinary People to win picture and Redford to win director. So I think the Academy got it right. But I do think it would have improved its legacy a little bit. But I think people still would have been mad that Raging Bull didn't win picture. But Raging Bull doesn't need an Oscar. I think Ordinary People, the Oscar cements its legacy a bit.
And one final question from Chauncey. How many nominations were realistic for Sutherland and what would have been his best chance to win?
That's also a really good question. I think for me, when I think about his career, there are a couple I go to. The first is, I think your scenario of Hutton going lead, Sutherland going supporting, I think could have given him a win. I think that would have been a really good chance. I think that MASH, we also have a chance there because in 1970, he was nominated for a Golden Globe. And I think he could have made his way into the Oscar five. I don't think he would have won, but I think he would have gotten a nomination. And then my last one, I would say he should have gotten an Oscar nomination. It should have been a slam dunk, easy nomination for him. Best Supporting Actor for Pride and Prejudice. He should have beaten George Clooney and Syriana in a walk. That category that year, Matt Dillon for Crash, Paul Giamatti for Cinderella Man, Jake Gyllenhaal for Brokeback Mountain. Love that performance, of course. William Hurt for History of Violence. Let's slide Donald Sutherland in there. He's another great dad. Also makes me cry in that movie. But I think it's your scenario for Ordinary People. And then I would say Pride and Prejudice.
The only one I would add to that, which I agree about MASH, is him being in Clute. I think that could have resulted in at least a nomination. That was the year that Gene Hackman won for The French Connection in lead. But I think there is space. George C. Scott, Peter Finch, Topol, and Walter Matthau. I think there's a way for that to happen. Obviously, it didn't, but I think that's my other performance that I really would have liked to have seen him nominated for.
So, big question. If you could give this movie one Oscar, would it be Donald Sutherland?
It's not, but that doesn't mean I don't think he should be nominated. I think I would lean towards Hutton for actor, and then I would say Mary Tyler Moore for supporting actress, which goes against anything the Academy did, but that's what I'm saying. And those two roles specifically, there's more to do, but I think that's also the joy in Sutherland's performance and subtle acting, but I will say that I would give it to them first. What would you do?
Oh, yeah. It's like, it's a three-way tie for me. But my favorite performance in the movie is Mary Tyler Moore, just because, like I mentioned before on our After Dark episode about School of Rock, I was so obsessed with this woman when I was a child because my parents would always watch reruns of the Mary Tyler Moore Show on Nick at Night, and I thought I was going to be her, and it was just such a shock when I saw her in Ordinary People. I think it is just such a brave performance. It's completely fearless and so, I think, just so different from anything else that she's done. And Robert Redford's eye for casting her and seeing what she could do in the role, I would have to give it to her. And then, I mean, I would also, though, I would give Donald Sutherland an Oscar here. I would find a way to give Timothy Hutton lead and give Donald Sutherland supporting and still give the movie picture, director, and adapted screenplay. So
screenplay is great too.
Winning all around. Yeah. Have you read the book?
No.
I haven't either, and I feel like I need to.
You let me know, because I feel like this would be a book that maybe you would like too.
I don't know. It's hard because I feel so connected to the movie that I feel like the book, no matter how good it was, would just be a version of the movie to me in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see the differences and what Redford changed.
I think so too. Okay, so that was our episode on Donald Sutherland, celebrating his life and great career, especially his performance in Best Picture winner, Ordinary People. I think it's, you know, as we've both said, he absolutely deserved a nomination for this movie, possibly a win. It is an all-time performance. And if you haven't seen Ordinary People yet, please watch it. It's streaming on Max right now, and you can also get the Blu-ray, which just came out a few years ago, which of course I have, but I think it's worth the blind buy if you haven't seen it. But definitely watch it. Let us know what you think. I'm so glad that we got to cover this movie finally.
Yeah, me too. My rewatch definitely enriched my viewing, and I would also recommend watching it if you can.
Thank you all for listening. If you like our show, please feel free to rate, review, and follow. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at OscarWildPod. And if you really like our show, you can subscribe at patreon.com/OscarWild for bonus content.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.